September 11th. Okay. I assume you've all marked the fifth anniversary in your own way. I hope you all had a good weekend. I did mark it. I did something I've never done before this morning. I went to a citizenship naturalization ceremony in Montpelier. 74 new citizens were sworn in this morning. It was fascinating. I'd never been to one. It was very, very moving. How many of you remember Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers' neighborhood? Remember Officer Clements? He sang. How many of you know why? How many of you know who Officer Clements is? François Clément is the Alexander Twilight Artist in Residence at Middlebury College, where he conducts the choir and teaches music. And he's been there for many years and is a favorite here. So those of us who grew up on Mr. Rogers are always happy to see him. So why did I go? My best friend was sworn in as a citizen today. So that's why I went. And I got a bonus. Professor Parabom from the philosophy department also was being inducted into citizenship today. So I didn't know that he was going through that process. So had a twofer. And cookies afterward. It was a nice way to mark the anniversary. And many comments were made about the United States still being open to immigration, having been founded on the talents of immigrants, with a little due respect to the natives that we displaced. They were also acknowledged today. Okay, questions? Let's go right to the fun stuff then. That is an illustration that is actually a photograph of a human ovum. You saw one in the video. There's one in the text as well. And so I'm not going to belabor the point. What I want to point out is that this is the zona around it. The nucleus is the major part of it with the chromosomes there. That is actually a yolk sac. In the picture on the video, I'm not picking it out here. There was a mention of a polar body, which is a little piece which the 23 chromosomes that are not going to be involved in the conception, the half that are not going to be involved, are isolated and they disintegrate rather than joining with the 23 chromosomes that are carried by the sperm. So that's where we start. We add a sperm to that. I'm sorry, I don't have a photograph of a sperm. Talia, if you would make a note, I'll make this an equal opportunity class, and we'll add a picture of a sperm and its nucleus. Do that. And you saw an illustration like this in the video. And this is the ovary, one on each side. Ovary releasing an ovum, which is then hopefully caught by the catcher's mitt of the end of the fallopian tube. It proceeds down the fallopian tube, meets sperm at some point, and fertilization happens there, conception. First cell division, forming a clump. Then a blastocyst, which is the hollow ball with an inner cell mass there, which is going to become the embryo. And then someplace along the way, the sixth day, implantation into the swollen lining of the uterus. This is the uterus. If I move that up a little bit, it might show the cervix. It does. The cervical opening, the vagina here, and the points that I wanted to emphasize are that if you look at this chart, fertilization can happen anywhere in the fallopian tube. It could actually, if the ovum survives long enough, it could actually happen here. After conception, after the fertilization, then the ovum is going to continue its progress down, and it's going to implant wherever it is at about the sixth day. So it may implant very high in the uterus up toward the fallopian tube. It may implant in the middle if it gets fertilized a bit later. It might implant way down if it gets fertilized quite late. The sperm don't have to swim as far. The ovum has come down. It also depends on the speed with which the ovum is passing through the fallopian tube, and that's variable. The importance of that is that if the conceptus implants high in the uterus, its experience and the mother's experience is going to be different than if it implants low in the uterus. And the major reason that it's going to be different is that the placenta begins to grow at the point of implantation. Ideally, you want the placenta to be high in the uterus so that it has plenty of room to expand. It will grow over a large portion of the uterus, of the uterine lining. It'll grow around and become essentially a sphere, a flat ovoid about yay big. If that happens low in the uterus, the placenta is potentially going to grow across the cervical opening. If that happens, then the pregnancy is at risk at delivery, because then you're trying to deliver the fetus through the placenta, which doesn't want to give way and is tough, so it's not going to give way. And as it does that, as the cervix dilates during the process of delivery, the cervix is going to move, it's going to dilate several centimeters, and that's going to tear the placenta, and that will cause bleeding. So the risk, if the placenta is, if the implantation is low, is that the placenta is going to grow across the cervix, and that's going to put the placenta first. The Latin for that, the medical condition, is placenta, squeakless chalk. Placenta previa, meaning the placenta is going first, prior, previous. When we know that happens, then we do a lot of bed rest. You may know people who've had to lie down through most of the last trimester, and a C-section will be ordered, because trying to deliver the placenta first is extremely dangerous, most likely fatal for the fetus and potentially for the mother, who may bleed to death at that point. In undeveloped countries, prior to high-tech medicine, prior to cesarean sections, that was always a fatal condition, usually for both the baby and the mother. Okay, so we're going to go back up now to fertilization. And this illustration you also saw in the video. That's the first division. So after fertilization, you have one nucleus, one cell. It divides in half. Each of those then divide in half. Each of those divide into two. The nucleus is replicating the chromosomes. Each time a cell divides, the nucleus creates a duplicate copy of the DNA, and then each new cell has the full complement of DNA. That's an integral part, necessary part of the cell division process. So each time that happens, you double the number of cells until you get to this point. You keep doubling, but at this point it's called a blastocyst that becomes a hollow ball, and that's the point at which implantation is beginning, typically should be. And at that point, the cells are beginning to differentiate. So they're not all identical. Based on their location, whether they're inside or outside the ball, different genes begin to be turned on. And as different genes are turned on and become active, the cells become different, because that's what genes do. Genes govern the internal processes in the cell. So you begin, as they described in the video, you begin to have an outside layer, you have a middle layer, you have an inner layer, and each of those layers is going to have different kinds of cells that are going to develop into different parts of the embryo or the chorion or the placenta. Once implantation begins, then you can begin to say, as Eli did. Sorry, my monitor's not working here, so I can't tell whether you got the whole thing. Okay, I want to go the other way. This is Eli's illustration of pregnancy. So, and these are his labels. This is the placenta, the baby's heart. He knew that was important. This is the uterus, and this is the baby with its heart, and this is the belly. I suggest this is relatively primitive. It's actually fairly sophisticated. Eli at that point was 4, I believe. I recommend that you, after class, take out a sheet of paper and see if you can draw the fetus, the chorion, the amnion, the placenta, the uterus, put all that together in its proper orientation, just to see if you can do it. I think Eli had a head start on most of us. His mother's a midwife. But if we go back then to look at what is going to happen as that baby grows, the text has some pictures. This is a schematic. And as you saw in the video, it has a neural tube, a groove, down through the back, what will be the back. It's fairly primitive looking. As it gets bigger, you have the beginning of the spine in cartilage, not bone. Here you have the beginning of the umbilical cord with the veins and artery going out to what will become the placenta. This is the head. As it gets bigger, you begin to have arm buds and leg buds, and a little bit later an eye, beginnings of a mouth, arms, legs, and a tail. which most of you lost somewhere along the way. Not everybody. Some of us have an extra couple of vertebrae at the end of our spines. They get in the way, so they're typically removed surgically, but they don't always get reabsorbed after delivery or before delivery. So this is the umbilical cord moving out into the placenta, and here you have a fairly well-developed embryo toward the end of the embryonic period. If we look at the outline that I gave you of the course of prenatal development, there are some other things that I want to point out. First is, no, you do not have to memorize it. No, I will not ask you at which day do the arm buds appear. I only know because I've described it 50 times. If you don't have one, there's some extras down here. But there are a few points that I want to illustrate. And the first is that if you look at day 11, it starts with days and weeks, and then after we get up past the beginning of the fetal period, it switches to weeks and months. That's the time scale. If you look at day 10, implantation is complete. It started about day 6, so that's a 4-day process to be absorbed down into the uterine layer. And by day 11, the embryo is beginning to have circulation, which means it has primitive blood vessels and blood cells are beginning to form, and the embryo is circulating fluid from what will become the placenta through what will become the umbilical cord, then through its body and back. And at that point, it's truly an embryo. The germinal stage is past. It's now a separate organism, clearly, and it's functioning, if it's gotten that far. A large percentage of embryos don't, or conceptuses don't get that far, but if it does, then it is an embryo and it begins differentiating much more rapidly. Size begins to increase. Now, what's the significance of that? The significance of that is that during those initial divisions, there was no source of external nutrients. It had the yolk sac. It was metabolizing the ectoplasm in the cell. And through each of those first divisions, the cells were simply becoming smaller each time they divided. It cannot begin to increase in size until implantation has happened, and it's beginning now to be a parasite absorbing nutrients from the mother's bloodstream. At that point, it's taking in nutrients from the mother's bloodstream and oxygen, so it can now develop much more quickly, and it has the stuff to build cells. It has the stuff to build its organs. The nutrients from the mother's bloodstream come from the mother's bloodstream, the lining of the uterus, which is the mother's tissue. It is absorbed into the placenta, which is the embryo's tissue, and it passes through two membranes. It has to pass through the wall of the mother's bloodstream, mom blood, which carries the nutrients and oxygen, And growing right up against that is the placenta, which is filled with the embryo's fluid, which is gradually becoming the embryo's blood. Oxygen and nutrients are passing across that double membrane. Waste products are going from the embryo into the mother's bloodstream. Ideally, those two membranes don't rupture, and you don't have any mixing of the mother's blood with the embryo's blood. They're supposed to stay separate, and the major reason for that is that the embryo is quite likely to have a different blood type because it carries genes from the father as well as the mother. So it's quite likely to have a different blood type. If the blood mixes, if the embryo's blood got into the mother's bloodstream, her body would begin to have an immune reaction to that and would reject it. And possibly a massive immune reaction. The embryo, while it's implanting, as it's implanting, can suppress the mother's immune system, but only locally. It can't suppress mom's total immune system. She needs that to protect her from bird flu and West Nile virus and all the other things that she may be exposed to early on in pregnancy. Yes? Because viruses are small enough to pass through both of those membranes. The question was, if they don't mix, how can you pass on viruses such as HIV or all the other viruses, or alcohol, or proteins, or sugar, or nicotine, or opium, or any of the other things that mom ingests into her system, from the size of viruses, which are about the smallest, up through all of the chemicals that mom is taking in, all of those are circulating in her bloodstream, and anything that is small enough to be dissolved in her blood or riding on a blood cell, such as a virus, is also small enough to get through those two membranes. Viruses are wonderfully adaptive, and they will, and they do. As do nicotine, alcohol, sugar, anything else that mom has in her bloodstream. And there is a difference in pressure between these two membranes, which tends to facilitate the passage of oxygen and nutrients and everything else through the two membranes. You all know about osmotic pressure. If you don't worry about it. And as the embryo grows and begins to produce its own blood, fetal blood, the kind that you have when you're just developing, fetal red blood cells are different from adult red blood cells. They have more oxygen carrying capacity. They grab oxygen, and they grab oxygen through those membranes. So the oxygen molecules are rather fickle. They're riding along with mom's red blood cells, and they get in the vicinity of the embryo's blood, and they go, "Whoa, I like this one better." So they jump across those two membranes and grab onto, or are grabbed onto by, the embryo's red blood cells. Okay. So the process is set up so that the embryo becomes a parasite, and mom's body is providing the nutrients, the oxygen that it needs, everything else it needs, and unfortunately often a lot of things that it doesn't need and can't use and would rather not have. And it's also the sewer, because it's taking the carbon dioxide, it's taking the excess nitrogen, it's taking the metabolic byproducts and passing them along to mother, because it doesn't have any way to get rid of them itself, because its kidneys and liver are not working adequately. And this is a good system because it lets the fetus go through the entire 9 months without having to crap. Mother Nature is good, so you don't need diapers. And you couldn't use them anyway. So it's very important that the mother's bloodstream is taking care of all these waste products for the fetus. Okay, moving on. 2.5 weeks, 18 days, the heart, the nervous system, the thyroid are beginning to be formed. 3 weeks, the heart is beginning to beat. It doesn't look like a heart. It's basically a tube, but it is composed of cells that have developed, cells which have the spectacularly unique function of beating. They just pulse. And when you put a bunch of them together, they just squeeze. They contract, they expand. They contract, expand. They contract, expand. And they do that. They keep doing that. And they get organized themselves so that they move the blood along and create the pressure that keeps the fluid moving through the embryo's body. And it has to be pretty strong pressure, because it has to get the blood to flow not just through the embryo's little body, but through the umbilical cord and through the placenta and back, because the mother isn't providing any pressure for that. It's that tiny little heart. Those cells that are just going squeeze, 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 and the blood's going, the fluid is going through the umbilical cord and out. Yes? Hi.
Mom, like, cut a hole while the baby's heart was forming, or other things like that. Like, is that going to really affect how the child develops? Like, would that affect his development? And is there, like, a better time for mom to get a hole than other times?
Yes. The question is, if these things are developing and mom is subject to these problems, such as having a virus attack, is that potentially dangerous? And that's one of the major points I want to make, so I'll just jump ahead to that and give it as a preview instead of a summary. The general rule as you go through embryonic development is that different parts of the body are going to be developing, differentiating, beginning at different times. And there's a general rule in principle, a general principle in development, which is that while something is differentiated, while it is just beginning, it is most subject to influence from the outside. So when your heart is forming, if mom gets a cold, if mom does things she shouldn't do, like smoking, like crack, like you can name the list. All those things you're not supposed to do any time in your life, but definitely not during your baby's beginning life. If mom does those things at the time the heart is just beginning to form and to organize, it is likely to be affected by whatever is getting her. And here you have the heart. Where are we? 4 weeks. Heart, eye, end of that period, the arm and leg. What this would show, if I reduced the brightness on it, is different colors. And during this period, early on, the particular organs are forming. This is the central nervous system, which is being laid down at this point. This is the heart a little bit later. Arms, eyes, legs, teeth quite a bit later, the palate, we'll talk about that in a minute, the external genitalia, the ear. If there is some problem, if the embryo is attacked by a virus, if it's subject to a great deal of stress, if mom gets irradiated, you know, watch out for your x-rays, then a major abnormality is likely to occur because the process of differentiation and organization is vulnerable in its first stages. Later, after something is formed and it's just expanding in size and getting more coordinated, the same influence may not harm it. So later on, shown in the yellow sort of here, you may have a minor defect or abnormality and maybe nothing at all. So in general, during the embryonic period, which is up through the first 8 weeks or so, when everything is starting, the embryo is extremely vulnerable. And if a kid is going to be born with a heart defect, with half a brain or less, without eyes, without ears, without whatever, without arms or legs, the influence is going to happen at the time that those organs are first appearing and getting organized. So thank you for that question. I was going there eventually. And that's a general principle you can take home with you beyond embryonic development. The rest of the lifespan, if something is first developing and it is subjected to potentially damaging influences, that will be the time you will have the greatest possible damage. So that applies to cognitive skills. If you're prevented from talking at the time when normally a child would be talking, if you're not exposed to language during that time, then language is likely to show major defects later in life. If you're developing attachment as an infant with your caregivers, and that process is disrupted because they are removed from you or you're removed from them, you don't have consistent caretakers, they disappear, you get flown across the world, and the people that you're with then don't create the conditions for establishing attachment, trusting, nurturing relationship, when you're supposed to be developing it for the first time, then you're likely to have attachment difficulties for a long period of time, possibly the rest of your life. The same kind of experience later will not have as major consequence as it does during the time when something is first developing. Okay. Any questions about that? Yes. How would it happen that any particular organ not get formed, such as eyes? Viruses, extreme stress, too much alcohol, cocaine, too much nicotine, poisons of all kinds. There's a long list in the book of teratogenic substances. Teratogenic meaning monster producing. That's the word that has hung on for people who have, for the process of forming major defects. We call them teratogens. The text gives you a long list. And again, some of them may produce a wide variety of consequences depending on what is differentiating at that particular time. So megaloviruses, for example, are very large and very destructive viruses. rubella, measles, is particularly damaging to eyes, ears, you know, central nervous system generally. So you can have almost anything not happen because there's been any of those teratogenic effects, substances there. So it's wide variety. Too many causes to list. The book gives you a pretty good list of them. It's a correlation without the predictive validity, but the point, and the point is a valid one, that as you're developing attachment, it's very important that you have a nurturing environment with appropriate interpersonal relationships during infancy. That's a process that happens across the first year, and it's very important that it happen. It doesn't always happen, and kids who don't experience that develop socially and interpersonally and emotionally differently. Even if that happens, as you go up into the second year, and we'll talk about this in the third unit, but as you go on, you use attachment, and you use attachment by forming new attachments with new people. But you can only do that if you've already created the basic skill during the first year. If you haven't, then what's going to happen is you're not going to form attachments in the same way that a child who has had the first year experience will. And if you disrupt the attachments during the second year, as they're forming, then people may have continuing difficulty. The farther along you go, the less difficulty you are if everything is normal. But for some kids, particularly in the adoption process, particularly in some developing countries, the entire social experience that infants and toddlers and young children have is distorted and abnormal. And many of them have considerable difficulty. On the other hand, it doesn't take much to create the basic skill of attachment. It takes just one reasonable relationship at the right period of time for you to figure out, okay, I can do this, and I can do this the next time I find a nice person who's willing to be nurturing. So you build up some hope and trust, and then, depending on the conditions, it will happen. So it's not true that everybody who's adopted around two becomes a sociopath. It depends on what happened before, what happened during that adoption process, and what happens beyond. That's the developmental viewpoint, right? Remember that one? The developmental viewpoint. Things are always changing, and you are constructing skills and attitudes, and what happens to you will depend on what happens before. Another question. At the point, the question is, at what point do you create identical twins? During the early divisions, usually before implantation, it's usually quite early, as I understand the process. If you go back to this happens. See, while I'm talking, somebody comes up and shuffles my overheads. You've noticed that. It would be most likely in the first couple of divisions. And what happens that creates identical twins is that at the point when that first cell division happens, instead of dividing within the membrane participates, the inner cell membrane participates, and so you get two completely separated cells. So it's essentially setting it back one step, and now they're separate. They have the same genes, but they're going to continue then through the next steps as two separate conceptuses. If that happens again, then you can have identical quadruplets. Any of you, let me ask the question, I haven't. How many of you are twins? How many of you are identical twins? No identical twins. Are any of you triplets? Quadruplets? None. Okay. Oh, well. But being a triplet or a quadruplet is interesting. And they come in just about every combination you can mention. When I was in Pittsburgh, I was consultant to the Allegheny County Mothers of Twins and Triplets. It's now been renamed the Parents of Twins and Triplets. They decided dads count. I like that. One of the reasons I did it was that some people in the department were interested in doing research on twins. And so I got to hang out with a bunch of parents who had twins, triplets, quadruplets, and quintuplets, but not all of whom had survived. But I did have one family that had four identical quadruplets, and they were fun. Other families had identical twins, and the third was fraternal, so they multiple ovulation. I had one family with identical twins, and they were part of a pair of quadruplets, and the other two were fraternal. So there were, yeah. If you can define it, there's probably a family that represents it. And they were a fun group to work with. Question.
Is the split genetic, or
is split genetic? The tendency to have identical twins by having the complete division instead of a partial division can be genetic. So there are families in which identical twins are common, but it can also be random. At that point, you're looking at division of a cell. The process is fairly flexible, and the membrane that surrounds the cell may participate or not. It just gets apparently recruited in on a random basis. So sometimes you'll see a family where identical twins are fairly common. Other times they just happen and you don't know whether it just is chance or there are lots of random things genetically and in embryonic development, and that's one of them.
Can you make this split happen? Let's say a couple wants to have.
Oy vey. Interesting question. Can you make the split happen? Probably not. That would be my off the top of the head, never having thought of the question before. Thank you. I doubt that you can make it happen, although there might be microchemical processes that you could do that would make it happen. But anything I can think of that you could try would probably kill the zygote or the conceptus at that point. What people do is cause multiple ovulation. You can do that in cases of infertility, or if people just want big families all at once, I guess. I don't know. Can't imagine doing that. But you can do multiple ovulation. You can stimulate that hormonally. So people have four, five, six at a time. I don't recommend this. Raising three, four, five, six children all at once is very hard on your sleep patterns, finances, and others. Question?
At what stage would the fetus have to terminate itself due to problems within it that it terminates without
life? Right. Let me reframe the question as, at what point can a spontaneous abortion take place? Anytime. Anytime. The process has difficulties from the beginning to the end. It's more likely to happen during the embryonic period. That's why that period, while things are forming, is the most vulnerable. Actually, the germinal stage is probably the most vulnerable before implantation, because you can just get swept out of the uterus or attacked by a giant bacterium, and there you go. You're gone. But what happens is that anything that interferes with development of a necessary organ, and there are several necessary organs. Heart is absolutely necessary. If you don't develop a functioning heart, you're gone. If you don't develop the brain stem, you're gone. But you don't have to develop lungs or a cortex or kidney or liver or gastrointestinal system, because you don't need them until you're born. So what happens is that anything that interferes with the development of the essential organs, the ones that have to be there, if you don't develop a placenta, you're gone. If you don't develop an umbilical cord, or if you have a distorted umbilical cord, or one that is blocked, you're gone. So anything that's necessary that is interfered with, if it's necessary for life, will cause a spontaneous abortion. There are many other causes. Viruses, bacteria, too much alcohol, all of those things, radiation, you know, anything that will cause enough damage in the fetus later on, malnutrition, you know, severe malnutrition causes fetal loss. So anything along the way that makes it impossible for the fetus to live will cause a spontaneous abortion. There are also external factors that will cause the fetus to be expelled early, too early to survive. So before about six and a half months, the uterus can decide it doesn't want to be pregnant. And some uteruses don't seem to be particularly inclined to stretch, okay, and to accommodate the growing fetus. And that becomes important in the fourth and fifth month as the fetus is growing. Sometimes the cervix is what we call incontinent or incompetent. It dilates too soon. Some of you may have members of your family or know people who are referred to as DES babies. I don't remember whether this text describes it. The DES is a chemical compound, and I can maybe butcher it as diethyl stilbestrol. And it was administered in the 1940s and 50s, probably 40s and 50s. It was administered because it was found to slow contractions, and it was administered to women who were in danger of delivering prematurely because they seemed to be going into labor too early. And DES was administered because it slows the contractions. And it works. And a lot of babies were prevented from being delivered prematurely by the administration of DES. The problem shows up in the fetuses who were delivered. And it appears to have, not appears to, it has long-term impact on the fetus's reproductive system, particularly the female reproductive system. Remember, it's a chemical that was affecting the mom's cervix and uterus, and it appears to have affected the cervix and uterus of the female babies that experienced it. Remember, it went through mom's bloodstream. It got into the fetus at a time when the cervix and uterus are developing. And they often have difficulty carrying to term because the cervical opening is thin. The end of the cervix didn't develop fully, and they tend to dilate early. So they are subject to premature delivery. Did that? Yeah, that was another of the causes of spontaneous abortion, and there are many, many more.
How much testing do they actually do for drugs like that? The CES, like thalidomide, you know, what kind of long term consequences to show?
How much?
Were they put the drug on the market?
Not enough. The question is how much testing happens for drugs such as DES or thalidomide. Thalidomide was never approved for use in the United States. So the thalidomide baby problem was not a U.S. problem. Our Food and Drug Administration was actually competent at that point, not to imply that it isn't now. It's under different regulations, and it doesn't. Stop. Okay. The Food and Drug Administration is extremely important in protecting us from chemicals in the environment that might be prescribed. And thalidomide was one of their successes, but it was approved for use in Europe, and the thalidomide baby problem was a European problem. Thalidomide is an excellent example. If you look on your sheet at the point 26 days, arm buds, and 34 days. Foot plates and finger rays, leg buds are happening, 26 and 28 days. At that point, if you are subject to any number of the teratogens, the process of differentiating an arm or a leg or a hand or later fingers, that process can be disrupted. Thalidomide was a drug sold in Europe. It had two uses, both of them common for pregnant women. It was sold as a sleep aid, and it was also sold as an anti-nausea chemical. So people who had morning sickness early on in pregnancy were likely to be prescribed thalidomide because it does keep you from being nauseated. Better they should have smoked a little pot, I think. But anyway, they didn't. So women took it, and only after their children were delivered did they discover that thalidomide is a powerful somatic differentiation interrupter. Right, don't remember this one, but somatic refers to body tissue. Differentiation refers to the process of becoming different or creating the cells that are different. So it's going to start being an arm bud, and then it's going to grow out, and it's going to be an arm, and then it's going to have a hand on the end of it, and then it's going to develop fingers. So that's a process of differentiation. And if you interrupt that process, and that's what thalidomide did, you end up without an arm, arms. Or you end up with flippers, a hand with no fingers, or no elbow. Depending on the precise time that the thalidomide was circulating in the mother's bloodstream. So there are thalidomide babies whose mothers took it over a 10-day period who don't have arms or legs. It is specific to somatic tissue. It didn't seem to interfere with their brains, but bodily tissues didn't differentiate. Once that was discovered, 9 months later, it was taken off the market, so it hasn't been reintroduced. Interestingly, you can now, under certain circumstances, be prescribed thalidomide, and it's actually being tested for some other uses. It is still available, but it turns out that process of interrupting somatic differentiation is important in disorders in which the bodily tissues are differentiating and dividing and multiplying, growing too quickly. And I just drew a total blank. on the technical name for what used to be called leprosy. Leprosy is a disorder of the somatic tissues, and one of its characteristics is that when you're subjected to leprosy, when you have it, your somatic tissues divide very quickly and differentiate, sometimes grotesquely, and then the tissue doesn't get enough blood and it falls off, and it's a nasty disorder. It's typically self-limiting, so after a few months or years it goes away. But it turns out that thalidomide is an excellent treatment for leprosy. It has a name. It has a real name, not leprosy. We don't call it leprosy anymore. And it is being tested for several kinds of tumor growth, because cancer is a process in which tissues are multiplying and growing too rapidly and not being healthy. And thalidomide has some promise as a cancer drug. So ideally, before you put something on the market, you test it on pregnant rabbits, pregnant monkeys, you know, whatever your animal to torture of choice is, and if it has any kind of bad side effects, you don't put it on the market. And that's why you do follow-up testing, so as soon as there's any kind of difficulty reported, you monitor the first wave of people who take a particular drug. If there are any side effects, then you pull it off the market, ideally. Or you go into defensive mode, deny it, and stonewall, and make your billions while the rest of us die slowly, or, you know, whatever. That's a political statement. Yes, question. No, they're essentially the same thing, and I use them interchangeably. Spontaneous abortion and miscarriage are, you know, they both refer to the termination for natural or other causes, a not induced termination of pregnancy. How does preeclampsia fit into, let's see, I'm trying to remember what I saw on television last week. Preeclampsia is a condition in which the mother's insulin level goes bananas, I think. Anybody know? It's also called toxemia, but preeclampsia is a condition when, because I think it's increased insulin. Don't put this on your nursing test. I think it's insulin. But mother's blood pressure goes way, way up. And that is potentially dangerous to the mother, particularly. And what I saw on television was some research on new understanding of predicting it and therefore being able to treat it early. I think the text, I think they just mentioned it. It's preeclampsia, and what that means is it means you are about to develop high blood pressure. Eclampsia is high blood pressure, at least during the period of pregnancy.
In cases where women have like sextuplets or quintuplets, do they have to get medication when they're carrying the baby to prevent them from having higher levels of postpartum depression? Or, you know, like, is it, like, does it basically, you know, how, like, does it get into extreme cases of that when they have the child or, you know, the children? But, I don't know, basically.
Okay. Let me divide the question into two parts. One is the complications of multiple pregnancies, multiple fetuses, having 2, 3, 5, 6 fetuses all at the same time. And the second question is postpartum depression, about which I know very little. And I don't think one would treat postpartum depression prior to delivery, because you don't know whether the person is going to have it. And almost everything that is effective in treating depression, I would not want my fetus to be exposed to. Don't do the psychoactive stuff unless you have to, for mental health reasons during pregnancy. I will tell you one of my experiences with the Allegheny County parents of twins and triplets. I had a call one day in my office from the president of the club, who asked if I could go to the hospital, McGee Women's Hospital, which is about 6,000 deliveries a year in Pittsburgh. It's where both of my children are born. And she asked if I could go over because a member of the club had just delivered twins. And I said, okay, she's already in the club. She said, oh, yes, this is her fourth set of twins. And this was way back. This was late 60s, and there were still many people who didn't know they were going to have twins. They suspected it in her case, but she wasn't sure. And she was having a meltdown. And she was not just depressed. She was inconsolable. And the president used several other terms that suggested that she needed some mental health help right now. I couldn't go, but I sent a doctoral student over. But I got the name and everything from the president of the club. I said, yeah, I can imagine how having your fourth set, having eight kids would probably depress me too. And she said, well, actually, she now has 11 because she has three singletons in there as well. And then, right, so I'm jumping to conclusions in my head, right? But the president headed off my conclusion by lowering her voice and saying very quietly, and they're not even Catholic. So, delivering multiple children could depress you, but that's different from the normal, the usual case of prenatal depression, postnatal depression. Postnatal depression appears to be a strong response to major hormonal changes that take place after delivery and during nursing, and abetted and aided by changes in the family and in home life that are likely to be taking place at the same time. The problems with having multiple gestation are not so much that it increases the amounts of chemicals or hormones that might lead to depression, but that the human uterus has a limit on its stretchability. And it reaches that limit during about the ninth month of a normal term pregnancy with one fetus. It can manage 8 to 10 pounds of fetus, 1.5 pounds of uterus, another 4 or 5 pounds of other tissue, and its own stretchability, which is small at the beginning of your reproductive life. So 15-year-olds, 14-year-olds, 13-year-olds who menstruate are ready to have babies. They will have small babies because their uteruses have limited expandability. The uterus will expand as long as it can, as far as it can, and then it will go into labor. It will restrict fetal size, but then you will go into labor. So the smaller the uterus compared to the fetus, the earlier delivery is going to happen. Okay. But other parts of the process of pregnancy are accelerated as the uterus begins to reach its limit of stretchability. So the babies of young mothers are likely to be small and likely to be delivered before normal term, but they are not as immature as babies that size and that term would be, who were delivered out of a uterus that still had room to stretch. In other words, adolescent deliveries are not as dangerous as some people will tell you they are. Once you menstruate, if you are well-nourished, not doing drugs, have social support, you're 14 years old, if it's expected in your community, you're likely to have a healthy pregnancy and deliver a healthy baby. The prime childbearing years are during the teen years. They don't tell you that. They tell you you should wait till your 20s. That's in this culture. Once you've menstruated, the body is ready to go. Go. No, I'm not suggesting that, because it's not appropriate in our culture, but in cultures where kids get engaged at 5, begin to be sexually active with their partners during puberty, and get pregnant within a few months of menstruation, of menarche, and are supported, and that's what you're supposed to do, and often in those cultures they don't have a marriage until the girl gets pregnant. I mean, if you're not going to have kids, why get married? So then they have the marriage, and then the kids deliver normal, small, relatively early babies. But their outcomes are not the disasters that the propaganda here says that they are. What happens here is that it's off time. Your family rejects you, your friends reject you, you're doing drugs, you're smoking pot, you're doing too much alcohol, you're having unprotected sex and getting viruses and bacteria. So your pregnancy's at risk. You're stressed, but that's not normal. So, where I was the uterus is going to expand as far as it can. It reaches its maximum expandability, its maximum size, sometime in your early to mid-20s. And the more pregnancies you have, the more expandable it gets. It gets flabby, actually. It'll go. And when it's stretched to its maximum, fetal growth will be inhibited. The factors that cause delivery will happen. And if you think then about putting two fetuses in that uterus, it's going to reach its maximum expandability earlier. And the fetuses are going to be smaller. So twins are more likely to be smaller and delivered prematurely. Triplets are even more likely to be smaller and delivered prematurely. And if you take that up, it's essentially the same thing. You also have problems in multiple gestation that the placentas, if you have fraternal twins, for example, they have different placentas. Their placentas have implanted separately. And the placentas may grow over each other, so they're stealing oxygen and nutrients from each other instead of from mother. And so one of a or more of multiple fetuses may be at risk because its placenta isn't able to get to the mother's uterine lining as it develops. So it may die, it may be at risk, it may be smaller than the other. Okay. But you were very good to wait until I got through all that other stuff. It'll come back to you. Will exercise cause the uterus to be less likely to stretch? No. Exercise is actually quite good for you and is now recommended. There's even the new edition of the text actually has a picture of a woman very pregnant jogging on the beach with her older child. And it says that exercise is recommended now, moderate. You don't want to go play rugby, especially later in pregnancy. But exercise does several things. One is, think about what's happening when you exercise. I'm sorry, I was looking at my watch, which is right, and that clock is 3 minutes ahead of time, so I'll get them synchronized, and I will recognize that we started according to the wall clock, so I'll stop there. But think about what exercise does for you, and what you need when you're pregnant, and you'll see that there's a relatively nice fit there, and we'll talk about its advantages later. Save it. Did that help?